Northern Community Radio 91.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we've got Native Lights Podcast, where Native voices shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with Translator K210 DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
Buju, Anin, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Willard Mailbear Jr., a Lakota artist who is the CEO and owner of Unified Theory Collective, and he's also the executive chairman of ArtShelf. Both organizations are heavily geared towards infusing creativity and getting art supplies out to the community. Willard is an experienced painter and tattoo artist who found a way to combine all his passions, embracing arts and culture for wellness. We spoke with Willard in March of 2024. Enjoy.
I was able to be an art tutor in St. Cloud in prison, and there I kind of found the power of creativity and creative fellowship and just what I was able to not only give myself by being creative, but the energy that comes out of you when you're being creative.
Buju, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lam. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a radio show or a podcast. It's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. And every week we have captivating conversations with great guests from a bunch of different backgrounds. Musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, healthcare advocates, educators, language warriors, and so on. We have a great mixture of passions. So we talk with them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And I can't wait to continue amplifying Native voices today. Cole, what's up?
I'm feeling good, ready to rock. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah. Hanging in there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Heck yeah. I know. So our guest today not only does a lot of good in the community, but he also is a tattoo artist. And we've got some tats, Leah.
Yeah. Wait, how many tattoos do you have?
I only have two.
Okay.
One of them is quite extensive.
What do you call the extensive tattoo?
It's my old man in the sea tattoo.
But is that, it's like a...
Half sleeve.
Sleeve. Oh, yeah. So it is pretty detailed and big.
It's nearly a half sleeve. I'd say it's like right before a half. So very.
So a little bit of a literature shout out there.
Yeah, yeah. I like that it shows not only like the sea, but also interactions between a man and a sea creature. And then also the best part about, I like it, is the moon. So the astronomy side of it. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I also have a question mark that Dad got before going out to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked it, looking at it. So I got a replica of that. It's a little bit bigger and darker. His is like pretty green. Mm-hmm. So mine's like, you know, kind of dark. Anyways, those are the two. We'll see if I get some more.
That's right.
How about you?
Yes, I have four. Two are Lynx paw prints, which is our doodame. And of course, I also have a literature reference of Gandalf the Grey. So a Gandalf rune on my left forearm and Gandalf contemplating walking towards the mountains on the right forearm. So interaction with the natural environment, literature reference. You know, I didn't try to copy you.
Not at all. Just copying me. Anyways, but yes, let's get to today's guest. Today we have Willard Mailbear Jr. He's a Lakota artist who lives in Minneapolis. Willard is the owner of Iktomi Tattoo on the south side of the city, where he is also one of the tattoo artists. In addition to his tattoo work, he's the CEO and owner of United Theory Collective. as well as the executive chairman of ArtShelf. Both organizations are heavily geared towards, you know, bringing about creativity and getting art supplies out to the community. So we'll definitely want to hear about all those great things he's involved in and about his journey. So here he is. Bonjour, Willard.
Hi.
Hello.
Howdy. There you are. How you doing?
Good. How you guys doing?
Cool. All right. So Bonjour, Willard, could you please start by introducing yourself?
My name's Willard Joseph Mailbear Jr. I'm an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Lakota tribe, and I am a Hunkpapa Lakota. I'm 38 years old, and I currently live in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Awesome. How are you doing? How's the family doing?
Family is good. I feel like all things in life, it kind of has its cycles. And right now we're in a really good place and trying to be the best parent I can be while being the best person I can be. My time with my two-year-old, I'm like 100% dad, you know, like on the ground rolling around. Emails don't exist. Nothing else matters. And then it's like the moment I get in the car and I'm like, oh, I'm going to go do tattoos today. You know, I kind of have to put on the jacket of, you know, the professional and kind of step away from being the family person until the phone rings. And then it's like, oh, yeah, dad mode all over again.
Yeah, it's fun being a parent. There's nothing like it, really. So, Willard, is there anything that you're excited about you'd like to talk about?
Yeah. Currently just getting ready to introduce my new nonprofit project to the community. Definitely been nervous and overwhelmed and excited. I'm just really excited to continue to serve the creative community and just, you know, play a part in, you know, the positive impacts of creativity as a source of wellness to people that need it the most. I've kind of started to identify that as one of my bigger purposes in life, you know, besides being a parent and a sober person. You know, 2024, it's just been really fulfilling to be able to spread the gospel of creativity in my community.
That is really cool. Yeah, I'm just looking at your website right now, artshelf.org, and seeing more about it. The organization has a mission to harness creativity as a vital source of wellness and resilience. That is so powerful, how you can embrace arts and culture to be well. But you have a good board that you can lean on?
Oh, yeah. So some of the fundamental of ArtShelf is essentially to operate like a food shelf, but for art supplies, thus the name ArtShelf. So one of our board members is Kylie Benson, and he's currently the director of operations for Loaves and Fishes in the Twin Cities. You know, they, I think last year, gave out like a couple million meals. You know, I'm definitely excited to have his experience in the food shelf. And we're going to do something similar like that in ArtShelf, where individuals can fill out an application like they would for food assistance, and they would be applying for creative assistance. And, you know, we'll have pre-designed creative packages that we can distribute with literature and resources on how to best use those creative materials as a source of wellness. And one of my other board members, Holly Henning, she's the executive chairperson for Women's Advocates of America, I believe. She has a lot to do with Indigenous culture also, and she served on a lot of nonprofit boards. I'm definitely excited to have her experience. And then our other board member is Colin Cash. He is one of the founders of an organization called Sober Squad up in Mille Lacs. He's currently working for a really cool program up there. I can't quite think the name of it, but
Anjibimadising.
Yeah. So, like, you know, that's our board, and I think, you know, definitely excited about it. We've all put a lot of good work into it. So
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Willard Mailbear Jr., a Lakota artist who is the CEO and owner of Unified Theory Collective and also the executive chairman of ArtShelf.
Do you, Willard, have an experience that inspired the organization?
Absolutely. 7 years ago, I was an active criminal in South Minneapolis and really had given up on myself. I ended up being incarcerated and choosing to not give up on myself. During my incarceration, I was able to be an art tutor in St. Cloud in prison. And there I kind of found the power of creativity and creative fellowship and just what I was able to not only give myself by being creative, but the energy that kind of comes out of you when you're being creative and how that can be absorbed by the people around you. Because even the community in prison, it doesn't matter what kind of mentality people are on. If they see art, they're in awe. You know, they're like, wow, that's special. And it inspires. It's cool to see that inspiration kind of spread and be like a common language amongst criminals in prison, you know, and being up in that art program as a tutor and being able to like mentor other artists, you know, all of that prison life stuff didn't matter. And we were able to really connect and grow as artists in a really cool space. I was released from incarceration 4 years ago, and I continued my pursuit in the arts, and I was in college for graphic design. And I had been a professional tattoo artist before that, but I really wasn't sure if I was going to go back to the tattoo industry just out of concern for myself and just the lifestyle surrounding where I was with tattooing before. I really didn't want to reinvite a lot of negative energy back into my life. So I was trying to just focus on being a graphic designer, but my really good friend opened up a tattoo shop. I started tattooing there. And then I was asked by Colin Cash and a good friend of ours named Aubrey to sort of lead these sober creative events. And they asked me to guide a group through a painting. I found myself back into that like inspiration moment where I could just feel like, oh my gosh, this is magic, you know? And this just, especially in recovery, when you're living oftentimes in that like one day at a time aspect, any sort of tools that you can have to get you through that day are priceless. And I think creativity can help people in all forms of social crisis, whether it is like relapse triggers or anxiety or, you know, depression. I think that just picking up something as simple as a pencil and a piece of paper and just getting through that day, it makes it so much easier to escape your thoughts. I did a couple of those creative events and I really started to identify that this, not just tattooing, this sharing creativity is probably going to be my life's mission, you know? And I was able to identify that pretty quick. Yeah, I think that's where I first started to experience and have a calling towards doing something like ArtShelf and not just tattooing.
That's great. Thanks. And to step back even further, do you remember like your first drawing, your first painting, or the first artwork that you've completed? How did you get into that? Like, what did you first start out with?
So when I was like 6 years old, maybe a little younger than that, my mom always told me I was 6 years old. So I kind of go with that number. But we were at my grandma's house and I was playing in their porch and I saw this piece of artwork on the wall. It was like this like scribble design, and then each little shape that the scribble made, there was like different patterns and shapes inside of those shapes. And I remember being in that porch and seeing that and being like, that is amazing. Grandma, what is this? And they were like, oh, your mom made that. No way my mom made this. You know what I mean? And my mom came in there and she was like, yeah, I did that in an art class when I was in college. And I remember it just blowing my mind, right? And my mom was like, you know, let's sit down. I'll show you how to do it. And she gave me a pencil and we did like some, you know, big scribble lines and then filled in each little pocket with some cool stuff. And I remember that being like the moment when I was just sold. And I was like, holy cow, this is absolutely amazing. My mind was blown. And like, I remember doing 1,000 of those, but that first one that I shared with my mom was just intense, you know? And, yeah, that was, I can never forget that.
That's awesome. And you and your mom have shared some art experiences, right? Like you, she was one of the first people or the first person that you tattooed?
Absolutely. My introduction to the tattoo world was ridiculous. You know, this really cool artist in Northeast Minneapolis kind of gave me a shot at being a tattoo apprentice just based off my art. And I tattooed a grapefruit and he was like, that is good. And it was all like, do you think your mom would let you tattoo her? And because I had told him that, you know, the first person I was ever going to tattoo was going to be my mom. And I was surprised when like that night he was all like, do you think your mom would let you tattoo her? And I was like, yeah, probably. And I called her and she came through and was just like, you know, I guess whatever you want to do, I'll let you tattoo it. And I think I just drew it on with markers and it was so sketchy and not clean, but it was definitely my introduction to the tattoo world. And, you know, when I knew I was going to start tattooing, I knew I was going to tattoo my mom first. Cause like my mom was like my best friend ever. You know what I mean? And I remember her saying that she would let me tattoo her if I became a tattoo artist. And, you know, I was just blown away by that because my mom was not the type. My mom didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She watched soap operas and drank Diet Coke. The fact that she was willing to get a tattoo was just super cool. And it was on my mom's leg and it definitely hurt. But she was all about it.
Was it both of your first tattoos?
It was my mom's first tattoo and it was the first tattoo I ever did. And it was on the first day I ever even held a tattoo machine.
Wow.
So is there an overall philosophy behind the tattoos that you like to do or just paintings that you like to paint?
I definitely, this year especially, found myself drawn to doing indigenous floral work. I'm the type of tattoo artist, though, where I will generally tattoo whatever. As long as it's not like hate-based or doesn't come from like a negative place, I enjoy tattooing all things. Tattoos definitely carry a huge part of my heart and fill my cup a lot. I definitely do enjoy doing those. And I don't want to say more, but I could probably say more. You know what I mean? I definitely feel drawn to tattooing indigenous themed tattoos more, but it doesn't take away from the joy that I have of tattooing conventional tattoo designs. And I do love having range. I like not being painted into one tattoo style or another. I like color tattoos. I like the black and gray tattoos. I like fine line tattoos. And pretty much I just like making art. But indigenous culture and heritage for me is something fairly new. You know, the first 33 years of my life, I really wasn't raised around culture. And when I was around it, I was either drinking and partying. I knew enough that I shouldn't come around when I'm like that. You know, my dad was really into culture and community and stuff. And I know he struggled with alcohol addiction and he carried a lot of shame with that. But, you know, he would sober up to go to ceremonies and, you know, would encourage me to sober up to go, but always stress that if I wasn't in a good way to not go. To be 6+ years sober now and be able to go to ceremony and be involved in culture, I think that's when, you know, the big fire inside of me started being lit, where I'm drawn now to doing more culture-related artwork and culture-related tattoos.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. Can you tell us a bit about Iktomi Tattoo and kind of the vibe at that place?
It definitely has a vibe. Iktomi Tattoo was, you know, a business project that was kind of offered to me as an opportunity by some of my friends that own businesses and essentially gave me the opportunity to be elevated as a business owner and an entrepreneur. They encouraged me when I was working at my friend's shop to start doing my own billing and start an LLC and kind of start managing my income that way. That went well. And I remember when I got out of prison, they were like, hey, if you ever want to do a tattoo shop or something, let us know. We'll definitely, you know, help you with that. And then when the time came, they were like, running your own LLC looks like it's doing good. If you want to get into your own tattoo shop, start looking for spaces and we'll help you get into one. I lived in South Minneapolis at the time. And so I obviously started looking in my neighborhood and I found the space that we're at now. And I was essentially just kind of like driving up and down the cool neighborhoods in South Minneapolis until I saw a for rent sign and I'd check it out. And I initially reached out to these property owners for a building that's one building away. And then when they contacted me about that space, they're like, there's a lot of work to be done in this building, but we have another space two buildings up if you want to go check that out. So we walked over here and we looked into it and yeah, I was sold. It's super cool because it's like, it's a renovated warehouse. You know, it's come a long way from when I first saw it, but I definitely love the energy in there, not just as a space, but from the artists that we have working there, right? And also just the way that, to me, it feels like home because obviously I put a lot of myself into that space, but I think it has a good like reflection of Indigenous culture, Indigenous artwork, and just this sort of like basement layer vibe in the best way possible. Nice and open, and we have a good sound system going in there. We have like, really cool TV stuff. It's a nice hangout. And right next door is my art center. So people that come in are welcome to come through here and like do paintings or draw while they wait. So it's definitely a special space.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Willard Mailbear Jr., a Lakota artist who is the CEO and owner of Unified Theory Collective and also the executive chairman of ArtShelf.
I've been kind of thinking about something birch tree related because, you know, I love birch tree look. I don't have a tattoo yet that like really has something with my native identity attached to it. And I'm trying to think of some epic thing I could do, but I don't know. I need to think about it. Are there trends right now?
I feel like there's like eras to tattooing more so than trends. A trend that I've seen are people wanting these really fine lines, sort of like abstract tribal stuff. I don't remember who kind of made that famous on Instagram, but I've seen requests from that. But I think like we're sort of in this era of encyclopedic looking floral work where it's a lot of it's just these like really sort of scientific looking drawings of flowers. Other than that though, I can't think.
Glow in the dark?
Yeah. So that era was like three eras ago. Every other email was, do you use glow in the dark ink? People always asking, and I got this UV ink. Is there any way you can, you know, have you ever tattooed its face with UV ink? And it's like, no, I haven't yet.
I was surprised. I had to get my sleeve touched up. And I also added a tribute to one of my buddies who passed. I was surprised that now they have this like skin, like fake skin stuff. I don't know. It's like a better technique to heal. It's that stuff that you just like kind of stretch over the skin.
When I got out of incarceration, is when I, you know, when I got back into the tattoo shop and I saw them like peeling off the stickers and putting it on people. I was like, what is that? And they're like, oh, it's the future. The future is now. Like, this is the best way to heal tattoos. And yeah, my mind was blown, but it definitely works and it's an amazing product and it just promotes such better healing. It's so cool.
I was amazed. Technology today, you know?
Yeah.
But I just really want to ask about Unified Theory Collective.
I'm the owner of Unified Theory Collective. It shares the building with the tattoo shop. So, you know, Unified Theory Collective was started to sort of be a collective of business members and organizations that essentially gave us some funds for advertising, and we took those advertising funds and bought art supplies with them. And so the community could come in and use the art space on a pay what you can sliding scale. But, you know, that way people could come in and have access to creative materials and have it essentially be sponsored by a collective of businesses that, you know, sought to provide this resource to the community as a source of wellness. And when people come in, I'll just tell them they can go, whatever's on the stairs, you can have. I had the idea to write art shelf on the wall. And that's when it clicked. I was like, art shelf. Did some research and the art shelf baby was born literally in the womb of Unified Theory Collective.
Well, you've done a lot of amazing things, Willard. That's really wonderful. And it sounds like you're definitely giving props to those around you too. So in that same vein, Willard, who would you say are some heroes or mentors that you've had?
First and foremost, my children, who are by far some of the biggest teachers in my life. And beyond that, my Lakota Dakota mentor, Shoshoka Duda, has truly brought so much knowledge and culture into my life. And he made me feel so welcome to come into the community. I was definitely feeling like an outsider for the longest time, especially at my core, I'm shy. I was always like really nervous about kind of getting into culture. And you know, mentors like Shoshoka Duda and the Owen family from Prairie Island, you know, they've all absolutely knocked down those things that were in my head keeping me from culture by, you know, inviting me to ceremonies and teaching me things and just like opening up my heart and my mind to Lakota and Dakota culture.
To tag on to that, like, what would you say to people who are trying to get sober or maybe in recovery and just want to, you know, rise up and get out of that and help their community?
I just try to spread that message to people that it wasn't that long ago that I gave up on myself and was out there doing crime in this very community. And if it wasn't for a select few people that, you know, believed in me, I probably wouldn't be here.
That was great.
Yeah, it was super fun. I feel like I need to do more. A couple organizations, a business. Wow, very impressive.
But, I it's that great theme that goes through a lot of these episodes where people realize a need. With him, it was, you know, that creativity.
Absolutely.
Miigwech to Willard Mailbear Jr., a Lakota artist who is the owner of Iktomi Tattoo in South Minneapolis. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
That is the sound of a chipmunk making the monk sound. Monking, as John Latimer would say.
Monking around.
Monking around. Now, I had heard that sound before, but I had not realized it was a chipmunk making it. And so when, you know, I think couple years ago when John mentioned, oh yeah, the chipmunks are monkeying around, I went on iNaturalist and searched around the sound until I could find it. And I was like, oh, I do hear that noise. I had no idea it was a chipmunk.
Sounds like a bird. A squirrel. Right? Squirrels can sometimes do that too, where I think it's a, like, I'm hearing the noise, I'm using Merlin. I'm like, why aren't you picking it up?
Yep.
Merlin.
Oh, it does the same thing with frogs. Drives me nuts. Oh,
we need frog identification. You are listening to another edition of the Season Watch Pod, a place to come when you're curious about nature, when you want to feel connected to something. And it's so fun to like delve into how things are changing and what's going on outside. That's Charlie Mitchell.
That's Heidi Holton.
And we're monkeying around today, aren't we?
We sure are. It's a good day for it.
Yeah.
I don't know about in Grand Rapids, but here the sun is shining. The oak trees are blazing. It's a good day.
Dang it. We've got no sunshine, cloudy skies, but I'm seeing the river birch yellow, which is very nice here on the banks of the Mississippi.
Very
but
nice.
Some big winds came in and, you know, lost most of the color around our region. So except for those glorious tamaracks.
Oh, here's, I know we don't have many tamaracks around here, but there are a few. Oh.
This is a fun way, you know, if you're hearing this through a podcast or on the radio, we would love it if you help us out. We always need help. And that means like, we want to know what you're seeing and we'll be talking to you more about it. We've got new methods to do that at the end of our pod today, but also tell your friends about it and pass it on, post it on social media. It's a great way for all of us to feel a little more connected in an unconnected world.
Absolutely. Connected with nature, but also with each other. That's the wonderful thing about this network of people, seasoned scouts.
Yeah. Nature nerds.
Outdoorsy dorks.
Yeah.
All of us.
I like it. So let's stick with the chipmunks. We had a little bit on it on this week's report from our liege, John Latimer.
Sometime this past week, the last of the chipmunks disappeared from my yard. Maybe you still have an active chipmunk, but keep an eye out. They're going to disappear. They're going to not disappear. They're just going to go down in the ground and live off of all of those sunflower seeds that they spent the summer stealing from your bird feeder. So they'll be fine, and they'll be back in late March. About the time the robins come back, we'll start to see our chipmunks again.
So while we were talking about that, we heard from Bill from Wabana, who said, chipmunk just ran across my deck. So they're not right on exactly on time, right?
Well, it depends on the chipmunk. John has mentioned in the spring that his chipmunks tend to come out later than other ones. And he thinks it's because it's in a relatively shady area. But I don't know. Phenology is all local, as we know.
And it's really interesting because now temps are cooler at night. We are starting to feel some of the real changes. We've got daylight saving coming up this weekend. You know, we all want to be a little cozier and do our winter things. And that's what the outdoors is doing right now.
They sure are. Yeah. The key to surviving winter isn't just staying warm and packing on a lot of fat. It's also saving energy. It's just not doing much. And our chipmunks are pretty impressive at that job. There's an article that I was reading a couple of years ago, and John was talking about chipmunks, and I was writing a story for KAXE. It's a scientific article in Ecophysiology Journal titled The Energetics of Autumn Mast Hoarding in Eastern Chipmunks. In mast years, like this year was a mast year for oaks where they just overproduce acorns. And the idea is to produce so many acorns that there's no way that all of the chipmunks and the squirrels are going to eat them all. There are going to be some that are forgotten or roll away and grow into new oak trees. And so in these like hyper-productive acorn years, let's see, during the peak hoarding period, they can gather enough food to last them all winter in 1 or 2 days of harvesting acorns.
They're hoarders.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
So 1 or 2 days of work all winter they're fed.
Okay, so unlike birds, they're not moving geographically, but what exactly are chipmunks doing?
So they're heading underground. They aren't true hibernators, like you might think of a woodchuck. A woodchuck is going to be basically unconscious all winter. They will not move. They will not wake up. Chipmunks are more, they go through torpor, which is another kind of deep deep sleep, their heart rate slows down, their metabolism slows down. But a few times every winter, they will wake up, they will go visit their hoarded food, they will stuff their little chipmunk faces with all of the acorns that they've saved up, and then go back to sleep. So all of their energy isn't necessarily stored as fat in their body, the way that a woodchuck might be, but it's stored in those acorns in their underground cache.
They're not interacting with each other. So there's not, I don't need to anthropomorphize this of like a children's book where they've got a whole city underneath the ground and all that stuff, huh?
I would really love to think that's true. It's not true to my knowledge. But the thing about underground, we know very little. You know, you think about how we know less about the deep ocean than we do about outer space.
Sure.
There's also this entire world underground that we are just beginning to discover.
Did you ever read Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim?
No, but now I want to.
That is, I read it as a child, and that there, I went through a phase like the cricket in Times Square, kind of where the animals have, you know, lives. And Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim was like that. There was a whole world, the rats living beneath, and, you know, governments. And I mean, just super, super fun. I'm going to kind of think that there's something else going on since we don't exactly know what they're doing down there. But we do know, as we see them collecting those acorns, they're planning ahead.
They sure are. In this same paper, they like radio tracked them to their little dens. You know, you can store up enough food in 1 or 2 days for an entire winter. You can store up enough for 2 winters. Some of them did do that, and they will, like, so these chipmunks will gather all this food during the good years, store it all underground. In spring, they pop out, do a little mating, do a little springtime run around. And then if they've got plenty of food in storage and the food out there isn't so good, they'll just go back underground in, like, August, wall themselves in, and, I mean, there's no point running around, maybe getting eaten by a predator, gathering not as much food as there was last year. You can just go back to sleep for another winter. And, like, I don't know, I always had in my head the idea of, like, chipmunks being these always on the edge of starvation, like, always out there foraging. We've learned that living in nature is always a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always true. It's a boom and bust cycle, and as long as you take advantage of the boom cycle, you can just take a nap for 2 years.
They're planning ahead. I like this. It's sort of like in COVID when everybody's buying out all the toilet paper, you know? I mean, that you're planning ahead. You got to plan what you're doing for a winter, you know? I could probably take some note from that. And I'm going to look at, this is kind of, you know, gotten me more curious about like whether I'm gonna see if we have any chipmunks around. I know exactly where they are, and at our house, and they like to bug the cat if she's outside. But I'm gonna kind of look at them a little bit differently.
See what they're up to.
So okay, so let's get into some of the curiosity part of this season watch pod. We had so many great reports coming from schools this week, but one that stood out to us. Tell us about it a little bit, or this group of people.
Yeah, this one is from Little Falls. The teacher there is Chad Kaditz. He's a middle school science teacher there and has a phenomenal phenology program that's been going on much longer than he's been involved with us. If you ever get the chance, please do check out his illustrations on our website. Each week he sends in their report along with the phenology topics that he draws out on the blackboard. They're just incredible.
And they have
students. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, they have a great Instagram page too.
Yes, they do. Instagram, and their handle is little_falls_phenology.
Okay.
Definitely recommend.
Well, let's find out what they were curious about this week.
This is Brody.
And Emma.
Reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phenology report for the week of October 26th.
We had sightings of flying squirrels and skunks. Most have been searching for food around our homes.
Speaking of looking for food, a classmate caught a coyote trying to steal their cat food from a feeder.
Spider egg sacs are easy to spot on windows and siding. And on sunny afternoons, we have seen glints of light reflecting off the ballooning spiders as they drift by.
There was a large flock of smaller birds that flew overhead, but they were making a lot of noise, so it was easy to identify them as red-winged blackbirds.
We have had a lot observations of larger mammals this week, including black bears, a bobcat, and a gray wolf.
A student captured multiple images of a piebald deer on his trail camera. The doe looked normal, but had a large white patch on her forehead.
We have been seeing harvestmen and crane flies, which both are sometimes called daddy longlegs.
The fruit of the high bush cranberry is easy to find this time of year, but we were surprised to see that they are still holding most of their leaves.
We have had reports of Canada thistle that was still carrying flowers and a unique sighting of blue violets in bloom.
There was a large group of 50 to 75 crows in a field.
Silver maple leaves have dropped, and the upper branches all have large buds that look like a tree in the springtime.
A student saw a tractor in a field that was hauling corn and noticed five deer that were following and picking up the spilled corn.
That is our report for this week. Until next week, keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
What a great tagline.
They said it best. So they're talking about some of the things that are changing, and I noticed they're talking a little bit, well, they talked about that coyote, mm-hmm. and then bobcat and a gray wolf. Larger mammals, and black bears.
Those black bears are still out there. They're starting to go to bed, but they're definitely still out there. I am eager for them to go to sleep for the winter because I have not had our bird feeder out since early spring because first the black bears and then the raccoons were getting into the seed. I've been without my birds this whole time. It's a rough life.
So we're going to hear from one of our good friends who joins us on KEXE, and hopefully will be on the podcast with us more, Andy Try. He is Dr. Andy Try from the Minnesota DNR, and we had a chance to talk to him this week. He studies bears. He's the project leader, and as he told us, he is the best job in the world.
I mean, I'd argue that I have the best job in the world, but it's hard to argue with getting to play with baby bear cubs.
Yeah.
I mean, I do research with...
Oh, sure. Yes. Very serious that Dr. Try is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But they, too, I mean, I think everybody, I don't know if it was in all the cartoons where it's like they put the Z's, you know, above their head, mm-hmm. like they're just, mm-hmm. they're always sleeping. And then at some point I realized people started talking about they're not exactly sleeping.
They're somewhat conscious.
So we're going to listen to a little excerpt of this conversation we had with Andy on the morning show this week, along with John Latimer.
For the last couple of weeks, I've gotten a number of reports of people seeing bears. And I just assumed that most self-respecting bears had long since gone to bed and were going to sleep through this winter. And then I got to wondering, does the fact that we're having warmer falls push the bears a little bit longer to feed more before they're going to sleep? What's the case? What's going on?
Well, let me give you the quintessential biologist definition, which is it depends. it depends how far north you are as to when winter hits, and it depends if you've got little ones in tow or are with cub, you might say. And so what we find is, in general, the pregnant females up in at least the Grand Rapids latitudes and farther north start to den sometime around the first week of October. I think the average date is like October 3rd for the median, so half are before and half are a little after. And then the rest of the females, the ones that had cubs last spring and are denning with what will become yearlings, those den somewhere between 10 to 15 days later on average. And then the boys and the solo females, they are out sometimes even a little later. We'll get reports of bears out and about during hunting season, munching on gut piles and that sort of thing. So, sometimes into the second week of deer season. So it's not uncommon, especially if you're farther south. If you're like in Brainerd or Sandstone or even down on the north end of the cities, those bears will be out a little bit more than our northern bears will be.
And just tell us a little bit about what they're doing prior to finding a place to den up. I think a lot of people just assume that, you know, all the bears go out and dig a den or dig a cavity that they're going to then crawl into and sleep. But that is not the case, I understand.
That's very much correct. So, starting in mid-August, their body flips the switch and they have to eat like the Michael Phelps training diet, 20-some thousand calories a day just to put on enough fat for winter.
And that just, that's like a biological, like up to that point, they're just happy to go along eating whatever, 4,000 or 6,000 calories, whatever it takes to get through the day. And then starting in August, they are like compelled to go eat more?
That's exactly right. Yep, it's presumably we think day length is the main cue because it's very consistent right in the middle of August. That's also when some of the migration starts as well. So we'll have bears from Grand Rapids going up into Canada. We have bears from Grand Rapids going to Brainerd. Brainerd bears going to Lake Winnie, eating out of the dumpster at the resort there. All kinds of movement happens in the fall. And they eat as much as they can. They kind of switch to a more nocturnal feeding schedule as you get later in the year, just so they can, you know, they have daylight's getting shorter and they need to eat a lot of calories. So they feed more into the evenings and the nighttime. And then something will happen where they either are, we don't know the exact mechanism why they do this or how they choose, but if they've migrated, they come home, generally the females. The males will often be like, I think I want a nice, quiet, solitude place to den up, and they'll often go up into the Cooch County Bog from Grand Rapids. And then as they localize, they'll either start digging their den. Bears almost never reuse their dens ever because, you know, if you dig it out of dirt, the top's going to collapse in midsummer. And so they'll dig a new den every year. It'll be in the same general area. But if they're younger or less experienced, or they just have been flooded sometimes, they'll be above ground. And so they'll be in brush piles or out in the cattails or out in the cedar and the tamarack swamps that we have, just like in a mound of sphagnum moss. And they'll stay there all winter long, wind blowing on them, you know. It's a little warmer in a hole. In mid-January, like it's about 10 or 15 degrees warmer than ambient temperature in that den. But if you think about when you're ice fishing out in March, you know, when it's nice and warm and there's sunshine, it's actually warmer to be above ground than it is below.
Do you think you could sleep on a bed of sphagnum moss?
I mean, it is very soft and cushy.
Mm-hmm.
But it does tend to be wet all the time.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound pleasant to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not a black bear. Yet. Working on it every day.
So they're in some ways, okay, so John's asking if like that's there's a switch, right? Where they start eating more, like Michael Phelps. eat is how Andy was talking about it there. But to me, that switch is almost like they're stress eaters. Like, I gotta get ready for winter here, man. You know, kind of like if stuff's going on in our lives, we might
life depends on it.
We might eat a little more. You know?
Yep. That can be my excuse for all my midnight snacking.
There you
go. I'm just living that bear diet.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Up all night. But I think our North Shore Community School students said something like in September, they only get 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. And the rest of the time, they're just chomping. That is.
So we also talked about there was the woman that was sending in a question. She's worried about her dog and the eagle, like last week, I think it was.
Yep.
And she's also had this smaller black bear at her house, and she's worried about this adorable puppy that she had. So she had this video from like her Ring camera. Bear is basically knocking on the door.
Yep.
And she's terrified, you know? So we asked Andy about that, and he's like, they're harmless.
Yeah, they're curious. I mean, and that's the thing, especially with young bears. They've got great noses. They're extremely curious. They're extremely intelligent. And if they get that food reward once or twice from being curious and nosing around human areas, they're going to do it more. I know I have certainly committed the cardinal sin of leaving my trash out unmonitored during early spring when those yearling bears are separated from their moms and just trying to survive. And we had a yearling bear who came and knocked over our trash can. My wife saw it and yelled, and it grabbed this trash bag in its teeth like a dog with a stuffed animal and went tearing off. And you know, I did not want the bear to learn the lesson that you get to steal trash bags from humans and everything's fine. And so I went chasing it. They are substantial creatures and they do deserve respect. But also black bears are pretty scared of us. And there it was like standing up next to the trash can or next to the trash bag in the middle of the forest, you know, and it stood up to kind of look at me and smell at me and see what I was doing. And I yelled and it stood there. And so I got closer and closer trying to scare it off. And eventually it did. But they are scared of us. Every time I saw that bear afterwards, it did come back two more times.
Okay.
It took me less and less work to scare it off.
Wow. I don't know that I would do that. Like when you're saying you're going after the bear, I don't know that most people would know to do that. Like I think it's trained in us to think, you know, oh my God, run in the house, get away.
And I think that's partially because grizzly bears are extremely different from black bears. And we learn bears as we should, we learn bear safety from grizzly bears because grizzly bears are much more dangerous to humans than black bears. And generally, if you act like a black bear is as dangerous as a grizzly bear, you're better off. Okay. But I also, I don't know, I guess I grew up, we have active black bears here in Stillwater. As long as I've been alive, we had black bears up in Ontario that we had to deal with. And so my parents modeled scaring off the bears for me.
Yeah.
I have one notable time that my mom, we had a dog, his name was Muggsy. He was like a golden retriever husky mix. And he had scared a mama bear and her cubs up a tree. Well, the cubs up a tree, mama bear on ground. And I watched my mama bear go outside to get my dog inside with a piece of like turkey or something. In between the angry mama bear and my dog.
Oh, no.
Herd my dog inside.
Wow.
And again, everything was fine. Black bears can be scared off, but maybe I have not.
You're not recommending this. You're just telling stories, no. Right?
Yep. Don't call your lawyer.
Okay, so this is really getting me thinking about, you know, all the things that are going on. And I love each week when we talk, there's words that I like a lot or I don't get to use very much. Andy said there one of my favorite little phrase, I don't know why, gut pile. Love a gut pile. Love feeding on a gut pile. I mean, we've done that before where, you know, we got a deer and then where we got a deer and then put the trail cam on the gut pile to see who came. And we got some extraordinary photos of eagles and all of this stuff. And or offal, it's also called.
O-F-F-A-L, yeah. Offal.
Yeah. So that's a favorite phrase of mine for this week. And might be a good band name for you this week. Gut pile.
Gut pile? Could be. That'd have to be a really grunge band.
Okay. Which I think you could do. But I think, you know, here's another thought of a band name, and maybe it's a little more new agey, experimental, you know, emo, biological antifreeze.
Ooh, yeah. I could get behind that one. Plus involves frogs, which are, you know, my favorites.
Okay.
Well, one of my favorites.
I need help on this one because I was this many years old when I realized what happens to frogs. I never paid attention or was even curious before the last few years about where they go and what they're doing for wintertime.
Yeah, and it differs. Depending on the frog, it differs. A lot of frogs will just kind of settle down in the mud, you know, at the bottom of a river or a lake and ride it out that way. But then we have our land frogs, like the wood frogs, some of our chorus frogs, that have this really cool adaptation that enables them to essentially freeze solid and reanimate again in the spring. Painted turtles can do this. A lot of our insects can do this. Basically, any of the critters we have here that stay here year-round that can't get below frost line, but somehow need to get through this freezing period and go about their lives again in the spring. And so it's a kind of a two-part antifreeze that they use. I try to think of it like, you know, if you put a full water bottle in the freezer and then the ice forms and it expands and then it pops the bottle. Think about all of your cells as little water bottles. And so that is why we get, if we get hypothermia, we get that frostbite so badly, is that our cells are freezing, the water in them is expanding, and it's bursting our cell walls. And that's why you get that horrific damage. And so for all of these frogs and insects and little hatchling painted turtles, they kind of do two different things. The first thing is they dehydrate their cells. So in terms of the water bottle in the freezer example, you squeeze it so that it's a little bit deflated and then put it in the freezer. And then even when it freezes, it can expand a little and not pop the bottle. So they dehydrate the interior of their cells just a little bit. And then on the exterior of their cells, they transform a form of glucose. I think it's like glycol. I'm not going to get the chemistry right, but they essentially make this cool chemical that when the ice crystals do form in their body cavity, not within their cells, but in their body cavity, it prevents the ice crystals from getting like large and pointy. So you have much smaller ice crystals form that aren't going to puncture anything. It's just such a cool and like incredibly intricate way to survive winter.
Yeah.
And it's the reanimation part that fascinates me.
Yeah, because I remember some of our students reporting on frogsicles.
Yeah, frogsicles.
Yeah.
That's what they're called when they're frozen solid, no heartbeat, no breath.
Some other thing is happening then for them to unfreeze and kind of come back to life, although they're not dead while they're frozen.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that, you know, I didn't study, and so I'm certainly no expert, but that is one of the things that just mystifies me, is when you have a frogsicle, no heartbeat, no electrical activity in the brain, no breath, is that frog alive? But come springtime, it's hopping around. It's making decisions. It's as alive as it can be. It's just nature.
Yeah.
Nature, man. Always up to something.
Well, I would love to hear from other folks if they've witnesses, or they too, like me, this is news to them about this biological antifreeze kind of, and how this whole process works.
Or if you know the trigger that, like, once they thaw out, the trigger that restarts their heart, how? Oh, yeah, I would love to learn more about that.
There's the question. We have some new ways for you to get in touch with us that we're trying out. Season Watch Pod is new from KEXC. And we are trying out something that is called SpeakPipe. And you can find a link to it in the description in your podcast and at our website, kxc.org, when you choose to go to the Season Watch Pod. And you can just record there a question, an answer, or maybe like clarify some stuff for us that we might have talked about this week. But we'd love to next week share some of the things that people record for us.
Yeah, please do. We'd absolutely love to hear from you. I would love to learn more. Please do send in something. We'd be excited to talk about it next week.
We like to end on a sound. And Charlie, what do you got for us this week? What do we want to hear?
This one is the classic chipmunk noise that I do know that it tends to do if it's scared or trying to yell at someone who's coming too close.
The Season Watch Pod is a production of KAXC, student reports made possible by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Thanks to the Bear Guy from the DNR, Andy Try, and our listener members. We thank you. If you want to get more about the curiosity of nature, you can sign up for the Season Watch newsletter or join our Facebook group. Chipmunk sounds this week from iNaturalist users Jay Broberg and Moses Mickelson. And of course, as John Latimer always says, onward and awkward.